This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
تحت كل حجرة ظلت كل شجرة بشوف ذكريات ستي وجدي فكل ما تسألوني انتي مين رح احكي لكم عن قوتهم وكيف احفادهم صامدين
Birds sing in the wintertime. Heavy nights, big dreams. Praying that we make it to 16. And even though I travel the world, we should let Isay Palestine.
Ah, fat, 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 الوقت عمري راح سنين وما ناسي هذه عوامر الخطر مجرور. Ah, fat, 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 الوقت عمري راح سنين وما ناسي هذه عوامر الخطر مجرور.
Was Saint Levant performing Dera and featuring MC Abdul. Saint Levant, for those of you who don't know, is a hell of a mixture. Half Algerian French on the mother's side and half Palestinian Serbian on the father's side. And the journey that he must have taken through anti-colonial struggle must have been something else. With that combination. We will be listening to more music from Saint Levant later, but for now I wanted to share with you a few things and share with you a clip about a really surprising opinion poll that has come out recently. But first I wanted to say that in terms of May Day events, as you know, May Day is actually Labor Day. It was removed by American capitalists from its proper day on May 1st to some random day that marks, the end of summer, the end of a season, basically, rather than being tied to its radical tradition of fighting capitalism, of fighting authorities of a kind of a socialist anarchist combination that basically fought for you to get that 8-hour day. That's why we have 8-hour days and we're not working 12 hours and children aren't working in factories, because that's what socialists did for you. If you ask the average American, unfortunately today, the average American worker, what is May Day, they would say it's something that happens in Germany where people will dance around the pole or something, and they don't tie it to actually to Haymarket Square in Chicago, where this went down, the big fight went down. For the 8-hour day that ended up in the lynching of activists. And that's how we got it. But if you go to the marches, the teachers' march, for example, teachers' union march in Lebanon, and ask them, what is May Day? Because they are celebrating this American holiday, because it's an International Workers' Day. They'll tell you what it is. They'll tell you that it comes from that day, that incident, that Haymarket Square, that state, those workers. So that's the kind of propaganda that has really destroyed and shifted around, shuffled our history so that it's not tied to its radical origins. So having said that, I just want to encourage you that on May Day, on May the 1st, that is, there will be a march that is for workers as opposed to billionaires, of course, to opposing the oligarchy, and not in the watered down way that Bernie Sanders and AOC have been spouting, but really a march by grassroots workers that are not tied to the Democratic Party, not tied to the Republican Party, not tied to any capitalist party. But this is about whatever they might be registered, this is about workers' rights and about fighting fascism that's creeping across the country right now. The other thing is that that'll be at Freedom Plaza from 5 to 8 p.m. on May Day, on May the 1st. Also, in Baltimore at Camden Yards Gate at 4:30 p.m. on May the 1st, there will be a march, and hopefully it'll be massive, because we have about 12 trade unions that have sponsored it and 35 grassroots organizations that have sponsored it. So I hope you turn out for those things. It's really critical. And of course, they embrace everything from US imperialism and the attack on Gaza and the genocide to the issue of our basic social services, Medicaid, Medicare, our social security that being there's attempts at robbing it by these billionaires, etc. So the whole spectrum of reactionaries that are imposing this thing on us will be confronted in this march. Lastly, just a good transition into our next segment, which is really an electronic intifada re short report about how the majority of Americans are now viewing Israel negatively. And this tapers nicely with the piece of news that I wanted to share with you, to show you Exhibit A, how these liberal arts institutions, such as American University, are actually they can do fascism all by themselves. They don't need Trump to prompt them or anything. What they need is just some board of trustees, somebody on the board of trustees to basically push them into basically muzzling free speech, into shutting down freedom of expression. In this case, this incident happened at the Katz and Arts Center at American University, where the chief of staff at American University basically tore down pieces of art that stood for Palestinian rights and left Zionist art that was shown to be bombing, that showed airplanes bombing Palestine, and was caught in the act. And when the artist caught her in the act, she refused to give her name. She didn't give her name, which means she knew she was doing something wrong. And it turns out that she was given instruction by the administration to do this. And that shows you that this is not incited by Trump on all his reactionary policies that he's imposing. They've been doing this kind of thing since, before years before Trump stepped goose stepped into the picture. So that's why these liberal arts institutions are falling in the eyes of students everywhere. And one of the things is that there was actually somebody from the Israeli Studies Department at American University was confronted these artists and told them that he told them a bunch of lies, and they told he one of the things he told them is that genocide is an opinion. Of course, they shot that down very quickly with all the facts that come from the United Nations and Amnesty International, and so on. But he basically said that he told another lie, which is that the majority of Jews in the United States support Israel, which this here study shows. Not only we know the polls, what they're showing, especially among Jewish youth, and that's the problem that Israel is having. That's the PR problem, is the majority of Jewish youth in the United States support Palestinians and are against genocide and don't want Zionism to be slathering their bloody hands on Judaism. For that gives us a good intro to this next segment by Electronic Intifada, which talks about this latest finding about the majority of Americans be viewing Israel negatively. So let's have a listen.
Which is a well-respected polling organization. And this struck me because it says, and I'm reading from their release, the public's views of Israel have turned more negative over the past 3 years. More than half of US adults, 53%, now express an unfavorable opinion of Israel, up from 42% in March 2022, before the Hamas attack of October 7, 2023, and the ensuing Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip. This is the first time I remember a major poll from, a respected polling organization showing a majority of Americans, not a majority of Democrats, not a majority of young people, but a majority of all Americans having a negative view of Israel. And then in this chart, which we see here, which drills down further into these results, this shows the shift since 2022. And you can see again, overall, US adults in 2022, 42% had a negative, unfavorable view of Israel. That's gone up to 53%, a majority now. But you can see even among Republicans and Republican-leaning voters, it's gone from 27% to 37%. Among the young, and you can see that among young Republicans, so those under age 40, aged 18 to 49, it's gone from 35% to 50%. So according to this, 50% of Republican and Republican-leaning American adults have a negative view of Israel. extraordinary, extraordinary results. And then on the Democratic side, where support for Israel has been eroding for many, many years, you can see that the negative views of Israel have jumped from even among the older voters who tend to be more pro-Israel, from 43% 3 years ago to 66%, two-thirds having a negative view. And among the younger age group, it surges to 71%. Yeah. And you have to consider that this is in the United States, where the mainstream media has put its whole weight on the scales in favor of Israel and its atrocity propaganda for the last 18 months. And yet, this is where they are. And that, I think, is why we're seeing this draconian censorship. Because when the elites lose support or lose support for their pet projects and the public is moving away from them, they have to try and beat people. This shifting opinion is the context for that.
Something also to watch. And I think with that, you know, I mean, we're seeing Democratic lawmakers working with their Republican counterparts to figure out more ways to literally beat that out of people, especially young people on college campuses, you know, trying to restrict people's speech so much, you know, in collusion with these elite Ivy League universities that aren't capitulating to the Trump administration's demands. They're colluding with the Trump administration's demands. This is something that these Ivies, but also state schools and public university systems have wanted to do for decades, is, you know, they see the rising tide of distaste, to put it mildly, for Israeli policies and the you know, really the normalization of Palestine solidarity activism on college campuses, and the board of trustees and the, you know, the regents and all of these administrative bodies that look out for the financial well-being of the administrations, want to make sure that their research grants and their, you know, partnerships and their corporate underwriting of various departments stays intact, to enrich themselves, not the students, not academic freedom in general, but themselves. And so, you know, I think we're just going to see more of this, sadly, but not surprisingly.
Yeah, but this shift in opinion has been going on for years.
Absolutely.
And the Israel lobby has thrown billions of dollars at trying to turn it around and have utterly failed. And it's inexorable, the decline of support for Israel and in every demographic group.
Yeah.
And I see some people commenting and saying they're surprised that those negative ratings for Israel aren't higher. I mean, that's pretty high when you talk about Democrats, or Democratic-leaning people, talking about 71%. And you look at the shift again in the other groups, we're talking now about massive majorities. And I think back a few weeks ago when we had Wafiq Faour and Zoe Januzzi from the Apartheid Free Communities campaign. And you remember Wafiq, who was one of the organizers who got those measures, those apartheid free measures passed in, what was it, 5 Vermont towns, and who was going door to door. And he said, you know, in his experience, the opinion polls are underestimating support for Palestine and overestimating support for Israel. That may be the case. It may be that people are too shy to say it, or the way the pollsters are writing the questions and all of that. But it's clear there's a sea change going on. And I think we need to keep that in mind and not be in despair and feel that just because the mainstream media isn't talking about Palestine, that there isn't wide knowledge of what's going on and wide disgust at what Israel is doing. And that should encourage us to keep talking to our friends, to our family, to our neighbors, to keep sharing the information, the articles, letting people know about these live streams and the segments we do, the other independent media, we're not the only ones, of course. We are reaching people and we're changing hearts and minds. And Palestinians in Gaza are changing hearts and minds by speaking directly through social media and sharing their experiences, and sometimes sharing the horrific experiences that we talked about earlier. But it is working. It's working.
Thanks for that reminder, Ali. especially in these very, very dark and grim times when we feel like it's hopeless, but it's not, of course.
So that was a bit by the Electronic Intifada about how this poll, this shocking poll really, showing the majority of Americans have a negative opinion of Israel now. This is the thing that they're trying to bury right now, that Zionists are trying to bury. This is why they can't stand to hear the word Palestine anymore. This is why they're arresting students and deporting people by weaponizing anti-Semitism, when in reality what they're doing is the most anti-Semitic thing that could be done. It's the only violent act against Semitic people that's happening, and it's defacing the basics of Judaism. And that's why we have a new generation, thank God, that sees all of this, unlike their parents, that still believe that, for example, the Democratic Party is going to save them, and still applaud when Cory Booker talks nonsense for 25 hours without filibustering anything, really, and not mentioning the greatest genocide in the 21st century. We are certainly led by the heads of mules, as the Lebanese song goes. For this next segment, is addressing what's happening. As you are seeing now, Trump is going from roaring like a lion to meowing like a cat about these tariffs, because he's losing. He's suddenly saying, I think we can come to an agreement with China now. Well, you know, what happened to all the threats and, you know, China didn't take a knee, so we're going to attack it with a tariff of 245%, et cetera. All of a sudden, it's meow, meow, meow. He's just a little kitten now, suddenly. Why? Why? Because we're seeing, China has been building while we've been bombing. The whole history of the U.S. since World War II is killing people, is based on the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about. That's why we base our economy on the military-industrial complex and what it does, on murder and mayhem, on decapitation of babies, blowing apart tents where refugees are taking place, and then blaming immigrants for the fact our economy is failing, an economy that was built by billionaires, and they kept on exporting the jobs overseas because they wanted to get cheap labor, and now they're complaining about this cheap labor. Now you have people like Vance calling the Chinese peasants, and they're so far technologically advanced from us. They're building things that we haven't imagined. They're building, they've built an actual infrastructure. Their cities look like something out of the future, not of the 21st century. And that's what he's calling peasants. He says, you know, we have, we've depended on peasants for cheap labor, and we borrowed money from peasants. You know, first of all, the Chinese are proud to having that heritage of being peasants. I'm proud of coming from a region that was filled with peasantry. I would take the big toenail of any peasant over any the whole family of billionaires. So they're more noble than billionaires will ever be. But these peasants are far ahead of you, Mr. Vance. And also, we're discovering that all these luxury items that Europe and the United States claimed that they are making, like these Hermes bags and all these luxury items, turn out to be made mostly in China. Even Swiss watches, like Omega, like they are. There 80% of them are made in China, and because the final stamp of a little piece of equipment that they stick in there, and the final Swiss stamp that they're putting in there, they can claim that it was Swiss made. That's why copy products are just as good as the products, the actual products, with a kind of a tens of thousands of dollars difference in price. And we're finding out about, how the dollar is falling in as a currency because of what China is doing right now. And of course, there's networks that are being, because this is a bipolar world. It's no longer just the US's world. People like Brazil, for example, now has made an agreement with China to supply soybeans, which the United States previously supplied. And so, in essence, this idiocy has hurt American farmers, as one of the injuries that has happened as part of these tariffs and attacks on other countries. And the other thing is that why is it that we're being told that we need competition? Why do we need to compete with others that are taking care of their people and knowing how to do it, how they're eliminating? We have to learn, how are they eliminating homelessness? Why is home buying affordable in other places and not here? Why don't we learn and collaborate from them? Why don't we share resources from them rather than compete? Why does it have to be competition? So here we have liberals laughing at the knuckle-dragging MAGAs, and saying, look, they're illiterate, they don't know, they're cultureless, and they don't know what's going on in the world. In the meantime, we have a whole liberal aristocracy that adopted neoliberalism that claims that capitalism will cater to human need, which it doesn't. It's for profit. I mean, and now capitalism stands naked, and I'm sorry for this image, stands buck naked, in the shape of the orange president that we have. If you don't see it now, if you don't see that this system is flawed, you're never gonna see it. And I'm not interested in converting the MAGAs. I'm interested in converting these people that claim to be educated, highly educated, that think that capitalism is going to end anywhere other than fascism. You'd look at the history of the world, where capitalism always leads us. So in this late stage of capitalism in the US, we need to be looking at other countries for models and collaboration rather than competition. So with that, let's listen to this conversation that we have here about what is happening in terms of this trade war, how China flipped Trump's trade war on him. So we can listen to that now.
Is telling Trump to stop whining and the United States rulers to stop whining over imbalanced trade. Trump put in a memo that there are 245% tariffs in total on some imports like Chinese electric vehicles, for example. But this has backfired in an intense way on the global economy, on the U.S.'s economy, and also on the U.S.'s geopolitical position worldwide. Talk about what is going on. How have these tariffs impacted all of these areas?
First of all, I'll say that not only has Trump's tariffs blown back in the U.S. economy, but in many ways, he kind of already gave up on the trade war that he started against China. So let's briefly go through the timeline here, because it's kind of confusing. There are so many contradictions. Trump will say something, his officials will say something different. So on the 2nd of April, Trump declared tariffs on countries all around the world on so-called Liberation Day. He held up this big chart and he claimed that his tariffs were reciprocal, which is not true. It's actually false. The tariffs were based on other countries' trade surplus with the U.S. trade deficit. So they were not based on the tariffs that other countries charge the U.S. This is why Trump put 50% tariffs on tiny countries like the African nation of Lesotho. And he put tariffs on this uninhabited island where there are only penguins. And he also threatened tariffs of 46% on Vietnam, which is a major trading partner of the U.S., a major producer of electronics and other goods. That was on the 2nd. And then what happened after that is Trump issued a pause on the 9th, a pause for 90 days. And this came after a variety of problems in the U.S., especially a crisis in the U.S. bond market, which really concerned the Trump administration, because if the yields on U.S. Treasury securities, which is U.S. government debt, you know, bonds, bills, and notes, when the U.S. government borrows money, it sells those securities in auctions and investors demand some kind of interest rate, some kind of yield. And the yield shot up at a time when the stock market was crashing, which is a sign of severe crisis in the U.S. economy. And Trump blinked. He got really scared. He was watching Fox News. The Wall Street Journal reported that Trump, you know, he regularly watches Fox News, and he saw Jamie Dimon, who is the billionaire CEO of JP Morgan Chase, which is the largest bank in the U.S. And Jamie Dimon warned that this would cause a severe recession or even a depression in the U.S. Trump got scared. He also was being pressured by many of the billionaires around him, like Elon Musk, and also Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, and Bill Ackman, the billionaire hedge fund manager. They were all pressuring Trump. Bill Ackman, the billionaire hedge fund manager, asked for Trump to issue a 90-day pause, and that's exactly what he did. So we see that, you know, Trump's real constituency are these billionaire oligarchs. And then what happened is so he issued a 90-day pause except for China. And every few days, Trump keeps boosting the tariffs on China to a cartoonish level, because once you get over a certain amount, it's just symbolic. I mean, once you have tariffs of like over 50, 70, 100%, most trade is going to decline.
Right. There's no trade.
There are only a few very specific things that no other country can produce. But I mean, if we're talking about things like, you know, toasters and refrigerators and furniture, many countries can produce that. But if you're talking about like very specific semiconductors or machine parts, like those kinds of things are very difficult to replace. So despite the very high tariffs, companies in the U.S. will still have to import those from China. So Trump, to try to punish China, to look tough as part of this new Cold War, he keeps raising the tariffs on China every few days. Now they're at 245%, which is just, I mean, China actually, so Trump falsely claims that his tariffs are reciprocal. They're not reciprocal. Reciprocal would mean that China charges supposedly 43% tariffs on U.S. goods. It's not true. China has a large trade surplus with the U.S. because the U.S. is deindustrialized and doesn't produce that much other than oil and gas and crappy Marvel movies and, you know, guns. So China doesn't buy that much from the U.S. It buys soybeans, oil, and gas. So the U.S. has a large trade deficit with China. So Trump claims that China has tariffs that are equivalent to the trade surplus that it has, which are not, it's not actually true. So then Trump put those tariffs on China, and then China actually responded with real reciprocal tariffs. So Trump's tariffs were unilateral. China responded with equal levels of tariffs. So then every time China did that, Trump added more tariffs and more tariffs. And then eventually the Chinese government released a statement saying, we're not going to increase the tariffs because at this point it's meaningless. I mean, they're just adding numbers, but it's not going to meaningfully change trade. So we're at this point where now tariffs are 245% in China. However, that was the first week. Something changed on the 11th, which didn't get a lot of attention because Trump quietly issued an executive order that made it clear that there were exceptions for the most important products that China exports to the US, which are cell phones, computers, semiconductors, and other electronics. Now, Trump claimed on his Twitter copy website, he claimed that there are no exceptions. He said the fake news media was misrepresenting it. If you go to the White House and you read the executive order, it says exceptions in the title. It says exceptions in the text. They were exceptions. What Trump said is, well, they're not completely exempt from tariffs, but instead of being charged 145% or 245% now, they're charged 20%. But still, that is a major step back, and it's an implicit acknowledgement of defeat. After 9 days of this trade war, Trump essentially acknowledged that it failed because the U.S. economy cannot go a week without these very important electronics products produced in China, including, again, think about how important cell phones are to the modern economy. We could not, the U.S. economy would crash, and most countries in the world would crash if overnight, magically, cell phones stop working. I mean, think about everything is built around this digital infrastructure. Computers, I mean, give me a break. The computer is probably the most important technology in the world today. And then semiconductors. Every computer, every phone, all these electronics products have lots of chips in them. They're very important for the modern economy. And China produces many of the world's legacy chips. That means that not the most advanced chips, but the chips that are used in most average products. So by putting this exemption for these Chinese electronics, which represent, overall, electronics represent over one third of China's exports to the US, and Trump has now exempted many of them. This is an acknowledgement that, you know, the Trump administration claimed that supposedly they had so much leverage over China, as Trump's billionaire Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent claimed. He said, we have all the cards. China has a pair of twos. He said, we're going to win this economic game of poker. But Trump immediately surrendered 9 days after he started this trade war, because in reality, it's China that has the actual cards. What this has shown is that the Chinese economy is much stronger than many people in the U.S. think. And the U.S. is actually much more dependent economically on China than vice versa.
There has been just constant trolling of these tariffs on Chinese social media. We saw China make several moves. China asked its state-owned banks to hold off or at least reduce dollar purchases. We also had China institute export bans on critical rare earth minerals that the Trump administration is very obsessed about, including these magnets, which are especially important for anything that is electric or gas-run vehicles, for example. Why did China make these moves?
Yeah, well, you mentioned some very important ones. I'll add another one. China has ordered the airliners, the airline companies, yes, which are largely state-owned, it has ordered them to stop deliveries of Boeing airliners, which is very important because China in 2015 made an ambitious plan. It's called the Made in China 2025 plan. And over the past decade, they had many areas of technologies where they wanted to catch up to the West, to the US specifically, and develop semiconductors and drones and artificial intelligence and all of this. And they met the goal in every single area, every sector, except one, which was civilian airliners. They're still behind. Although China now, as of 2023, has been producing its own airliners, its own jets. However, they rely on parts from the United States and from some European countries. So in the civilian airliner industry, it's a duopoly. There are two main companies, which is Boeing, which has destroyed its reputation. It's being run by these finance bros with no engineering experience. They just want to maximize the stock price and get paid fat bonuses while they've let safety fall to the wayside and stopped investing and laid off good unionized workers who were trained and hired contractors who were not well-trained. So they've destroyed Boeing. The other major competitor is a European company called Airbus, and they're a duopoly. So now China, over years, has been trying to develop its own competitor, and this is going to kickstart China's drive to have a competitor to Boeing. And I guarantee you, in the next few years, China will have its own civilian airliners with its own domestically made parts. Maybe there will be some parts from Russia. Russia has some companies that make plane parts as well, but it's not going to have any Western parts. And this is so similar to what happened with semiconductors, because in Trump's first term in 2018, he started the trade war in 2000. Well, his first term was 2017, but in 2018, Trump started the trade war in China, and he put sanctions on Huawei and some other Chinese companies. And then when Biden came in, some people thought that he would do something different, but no, of course, he continued this bipartisan trade war and new Cold War against China. And then not only did Biden keep Trump's tariffs on China, he added more. And in particular, the Biden White House put export restrictions on China to try to prevent China from getting access to the most cutting edge semiconductors, these chips that would be needed for research on artificial intelligence, or so they thought. Now, we've seen that China has already made enormous progress. Chinese companies like DeepSeek have surprised the world by releasing these models that, one, are just as good as the models being produced by the U.S. major company OpenAI, which should be called ClosedAI because it's actually not open source. OpenAI is 49% owned by Microsoft. And it's the CEO of OpenAI is the billionaire oligarch Sam Altman, who was invited to the White House just a few hours after Trump's inauguration this January to announce this Stargate project with $500 billion of investment in USAI. And then a few days later, China's DeepSeek releases this model that is, one, not only as good at, or not only as good or potentially even better as the, than the models produced by OpenAI, but two, it's open source. Anyone around the world can use this program for free. They can run it on their computer locally. So that's a game changer. So the US thought that by restricting advanced chips that China would not be able to catch up in AI, but China has already caught up and is making huge progress. So we talked about how China is going to be catching up soon in airliners. It's already caught up in AI, and China is developing its own domestic semiconductor industry. As I already said earlier, China is the world's leader in the production of what are known as legacy chips, not the most cutting edge, but the less high-tech chips that are in like every modern electronic product that we use. And China is already dominating that industry, and it's moving to catch up soon in the most cutting edge chips. Especially Huawei has been working with this Chinese partially state-owned company, which is called SMIC, the Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation. And together they've been making very cutting edge chips, including 7-nanometer chips that were released in the Mate 60 Pro, the Huawei phone last year. So China's making a lot of progress in that area. And now with these Trump tariffs, it's going to further incentivize China to develop its own domestic capacities in airliners, in semiconductors, in artificial intelligence, and in other industries, because every few days they announce new restrictions. So the Trump administration just ordered NVIDIA, the major US chip designing company, which has a monopoly in many of these advanced chip designs. The Trump White House ordered them to stop shipping certain chips to China. So they keep expanding the dragnet, and they expect that China can't respond. But as you acknowledge, China has responded in several ways. So let's talk briefly about rare earth elements. This is also very important for modern technologies because the supply chains for cell phones, computers, even the military technology used by the US, these supply chains are very complex. The US has many military technologies, like famously the F-35 plane, that rely on lots of rare earths. Where do those rare earths come from? Well, China dominates the global supply chain for the processing, for the extraction and processing of rare earths. Now, the term rare earth can be kind of misleading. People think that it's very rare, as in there are not many rare earth elements, but there actually are, there's quite a bit of rare earth elements around the world, but they're often not located in very concentrated areas. They're often spread out. So you have to find concentrated areas. And when they are processed, it's very toxic. It's very difficult to do. And it takes a lot of skilled workers. And it takes a lot of this technology that the U.S. has not invested in, because U.S. capitalists prefer investing on Wall Street in financial speculation. They don't want to invest in mining rare earths, which is not profitable. It's risky. And they can get much more return on investment by buying up existing assets through private equity or simply investing in the stock market. I mean, so there's been a massive shortage of investment in the U.S. That's why the U.S. is deindustrialized, because it's not very profitable to invest in manufacturing. Trump expects that putting tariffs on will magically reindustrialize the U.S., but you know, these capitalists, they just want to make money. They're just following their own economic interests. And it's very difficult, very complex, and risky to make a factory, to train workers, to invest in all of these, this capital expenditure, all these machines and such. And then you might not even make a good product. It might not sell well. You have to compete against many other companies and you might lose money. Whereas, you know, if you invest in the stock market, you buy up existing assets through private equity, you asset strip, it's much easier to make money. So China has invested in these supply chains and dominates the production of rare earths and other critical minerals, which is why the U.S. government is obsessed with trying to remove China from the supply chain. Because from their perspective of these imperial planners in Washington, they're preparing for war on China. Very clearly, the defense secretary that Trump appointed, this Christian fundamentalist extremist, Pete Hegseth, who wrote a book in 2020 titled American Crusade. And he says that we're in a holy war. That's the term he used on the first page of his book. He says the U.S. is in a holy war against China and Islam. There are nearly 2 billion Muslims in the world, and against the international left, he says. So this is the guy who's running the Pentagon. In his book, he said that he wants to overthrow the Communist Party of China. That's calling for overthrowing the Chinese government. So this guy is extremist. Pete Hegseth said that they're turning Japan into a war fighting base to prepare for a war on China. So everything the Trump administration and the Biden administration before that, this is bipartisan. In Washington, there is a bipartisan consensus of a new Cold War on China, and they're preparing for war on China. They have a big problem. They rely on China for producing everything, not only phones and computers and semiconductors, but also the critical minerals that are needed to make the weapons that the U.S. military needs for war on China. So this is why they're so obsessed with removing China from the supply chain, because they recognize that if and when there's a U.S. war on China, China can cut off those mineral exports to the U.S., and then the U.S. doesn't have the minerals it needs to make the weapons for war on China. So the U.S. Congress has a special committee on China, very anti-China committee, and they published a report detailing ideas for trying to create new supply chains. So this is why Trump is constantly talking about rare earths, or he sometimes calls them raw earths, but whatever. The point is that what all of this shows in the past few weeks is that the U.S. thinks that it's going to be so easy to bully China around, to remove China from supply chains, to decouple economically from China. The Trump administration's top officials, like, you know, Scott Bessent, the billionaire Treasury Secretary, or Howard Lutnick, the billionaire Commerce Secretary, they keep going on TV and saying, China is dependent on us. We have all the cards. It's going to be easy. They have no alternatives. They sell it to the U.S. market. And then China has shown literally in one week, China showed the U.S. that actually it's in a much stronger position. And the U.S. economy is actually much weaker than many people think. It is a house of cards.
The Trump administration are literally using these tariffs to build up for war with China. Here's what Scott Bessent had to say recently to none other than the American Bankers Association.
Unfortunately, the biggest offender in the global trading system is China. And they're the only country who's escalated. And you know, I can tell the rest of the world that I'm not sure whether it was the prime minister or the economic minister in Spain made some comments this morning. Oh, well, maybe we should align ourselves more with China. That would be cutting your own throat, because I can tell you that these Chinese exports that the U.S. tariff wall is going to keep out, that China for all of you who can remember that Disney movie of the brooms carrying the buckets of water, that is the Chinese business model. It never stops. They just keep producing and producing and dumping and dumping, and it's going somewhere. And you know, I think, Rob, at the end of the day, that we can probably reach the a deal with our allies, with the other countries that have been long-term, they've been good military allies, not perfect economic allies, and then we can approach China as a group.
Approaching China, which means confronting China, war on China.
It's obvious that the Trump administration thought that they would threaten these really high tariffs on China, and then China would, like many countries, would beg the U.S. to please stop. As Trump said in this Republican Party gala, he said, 75 countries came to me and they're kissing my ass. I mean, it's so arrogant. And other countries can, they can, they have internet. They can see these clips and see how Trump's talking about them. So he expected that Trump would be like, please, please, sir, take down the tariffs. Please, we will do anything. But actually, China's the only country that, I mean, other countries have had dignity and have stood up for themselves. But China's the only country that actually said to the U.S., okay, we will respond with reciprocal, actual reciprocal tariffs. And that's why Scott Bessent is absurdly portraying China as the aggressor. It was not China that started this. It was Trump that started this by imposing first 63% tariffs on China, which is crazy. That would reduce the vast majority of trade between the U.S. and China. So then China said, fine, if you're going to hit us with 63% tariffs, we're going to respond with reciprocal tariffs. And every time China responds, Trump hits it with more. I mean, it's so similar to the portrayal of Israel, right? Israel kills Palestinians, occupies them, imposes a siege on Gaza for 2 decades. And then when Palestinians fight back, when little kids throw rocks at the soldiers occupying their country illegally, then the Western corporate media says the Palestinians started it. And then Israel attacks more, and Israel says it's self-defense, even though Israel is the one that started it. I mean, this is the strategy of imperialists throughout history, of colonialists. They attack an indigenous people, and then the people fight back in self-defense. And then the colonialists say, we have to defend ourselves, and we are the ones who are actually on the good side. And then the indigenous people are supposedly the aggressors. This is exactly how the U.S. is treating China. The U.S. started this aggressive trade war against China. China responds proportionally, and then the U.S. keeps ratcheting it up. And so Scott Bessent says that he wants other countries to come with the U.S. together in a group in order to isolate China. This has been the U.S. strategy for years. What is the U.S. going to offer these countries, especially after the Trump administration has been isolating itself from Europe? I mean, honestly, I think this is good for Europe. I think Europe should pursue an independent foreign policy. The more that it has subordinated itself to the United States, the more it has hurt the European economy. You see.
Amen to that. That was Danny Haifong interviewing the brilliant Ben Norton about China and these tariffs and how the China flipped the script on basically on Trump with this. And we heard some really idiotic comparisons by these people that are leading our country that are a loss for words, explaining Chinese economy as a bunch of characters from the movie Fantasia, because he's at a loss of what to say about what's happening. The fact that nothing can happen in terms of manufacturing, practically nothing can happen without China's help. It wasn't their idea to set it up. It was the idea of American capitalists to seek cheap labor wherever they could find it. And that's where we are. That's how we got to where we are today. And you're going to be, I mean, this is already an old story. The stories that are coming out today in terms of what's happening in terms of currency and the dollar and what China, the moves China's doing to devaluate the dollar, for lack of a better word, is pretty incredible. And you're going to be hearing about it. It hasn't seeped into the mainstream media, but you're going to be hearing about it, and you're going to know it's a historical event. And with that, we'll see you next Wednesday at 2 p.m. And this is Zain Lamin signing off for the Shayo Nana Show.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israeli airstrikes on a school-turned shelter in Gaza City have killed at least 23 people, setting tents ablaze, burning some alive. Meanwhile, France, Germany, and Britain condemned Israel's seven-week blockade on all imports to Gaza, including humanitarian aid, as intolerable. Gaza's health ministry says thousands of children are surviving on less than a meal a day. United Nations spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric says malnutrition is on the rise.
Several people suffering from severe acute malnutrition have been admitted to hospitals for treatment this week, with cases on the rise. Despite extremely low supplies, some 180 community kitchens in Gaza continue to operate every day. However, many of these kitchens are at imminent risk of closing due to the shutting down, since the stocks are being depleted.
Arab mediators, meanwhile, are working on a proposal to end the war that would include a 5 to 7 year truce and the release of all remaining hostages. Palestine's President Mahmoud Abbas called on Hamas to release the hostages in order to, what he said was, block Israel's pretext for continuing the war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has unveiled a massive overhaul of the State Department, reducing the staff by 15% while closing and consolidating more than 100 bureaus worldwide. Those likely to be eliminated include the Office of Global Women's Issues, as well as the State Department's diversity and inclusion efforts. Spokesperson Tammy Bruce.
The sprawling bureaucracy created a system more beholden to radical political ideology than advancing America's core national interests. That is why today Secretary Rubio is announcing a comprehensive reorganization plan that will bring the department into the 21st century.
It follows the Trump administration's near gutting of the USAID, the Agency for International Development, with an estimated $40 billion budget focused largely on humanitarian aid. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is assailing the International Monetary Fund and World Bank after they warned Tuesday President Donald Trump's tariffs could cause inflation. Trump Tuesday said 145% tariffs on China could come down substantially. Today, he said negotiations with countries continue. Six Democrats traveled to the detention facility in Louisiana, where the Trump administration is holding two visa holders who've spoken out against Israel's war in Gaza: Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil and Tufts University PhD student Ramesa Ozturk. They both have American-born children. The administration is moving to deport them. Here's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey and Congressmembers Jim McGovern and Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts speaking outside the facility.
It's a national disgrace what is taking place. They are not being charged with a crime. There is no evidence that could convict them of a crime.
Both of these individuals are political prisoners. I really worry that this administration is ushering in a new era of McCarthyism.
Mahmoud Khalil has lived in Syria under Assad. He knows what an authoritarian regime looks like. And he says, this is it.
Markey says the Trump administration has sent the two 1,000 miles from their homes to Louisiana before the most conservative appellate court in order to defend its abduction and detention of migrants the administration disagrees with, seeking a more favorable ruling of its actions. Markey noted Ozturk simply wrote an op-ed. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave a dire warning about the state of the climate today and said a meeting with diverse diplomats affirms a global commitment to climate action at this year's climate discussions, COP30 in Brazil.
We don't have a moment to lose. No region is being spared from the ravages of accelerating climate catastrophes. and the crisis is deepening.